Today is Wednesday, January 27th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, global COVID-19 cases pass 100 million.
Countries across the globe are struggling with new variants of the virus and vaccine shortfalls, while more than 2 million people have died from the disease.
Also ahead, the U.S. has custody of a suspected Kenyan wildlife trafficker.
It could be a game-changing tactic to disrupt and deter wildlife trafficking syndicates.
Plus, Republican senators are unlikely to vote to convict former U.S. President Donald Trump. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is COVID-19. Global coronavirus cases surpassed 100 million on Wednesday, according to a Reuters tally, as countries around the world struggle with new virus variants and vaccine shortfalls. Gloria So of Reuters has that story.
Global coronavirus cases surpassed 100 million on Wednesday, according to a Reuters tally. That's a staggering 1.3% of the world's population. Countries across the globe are struggling with new variants of the virus and vaccine shortfalls, while more than 2 million people have died from the disease. The United States, India, Brazil, Russia, and the United Kingdom round out the top five worst affected countries. Together, their populations represent over a quarter of the globe, but their case numbers make up more than half of those reported. With over 25 million cases alone, the United States has a quarter of all reported COVID-19 cases, though it accounts for just 4% of the world's population. It also leads the world in the number of lives lost to the disease, with over 420,000 deaths, followed by Brazil. In India, the nation with the second highest number of cases, infections have been decreasing, but still hover around 13,000 a day on average. And as the worst affected region in the world, Europe is currently reporting a million new infections about every 4 days and has reported nearly 30 million since the global health crisis began. For leaders everywhere, vaccines are the light at the end of the tunnel. Although rollouts have started in about 56 countries, vaccine distribution across the world remains unequal. Africa, which accounts for nearly 3.5 million cases and over 85,000 deaths, is still scrambling to secure vaccine supplies, and many European countries are facing shipment delays from major vaccine makers like AstraZeneca and Pfizer. Meanwhile, a new threat has emerged. COVID-19 variants, one first identified in Britain and another in South Africa, which is 50% more infectious and now spreading in at least 20 countries.
That was Gloria So of Reuters. As the world surpasses 100 million coronavirus infections, it's dealing with multiple variants of the original disease. What's known about these mutations and what gaps in our knowledge base remain? To find out, International Edition's Steve Miller spoke to Dr. Zach Jenkins, who is an associate professor of pharmacy practice with Cedarville University in the U.S. state of Ohio.
So I think the first thing to understand is that as this pandemic continues to roll onward, we will continue to see more variants. That's inevitable. It just so happens as we have more and more virus circulate and it produces more and more of itself, you start to see these little mutations, these offshoots occur. When it comes to looking at all of these, though, I think probably the way that we can kind of group them together are questions of, well, three big questions. Number one, first off, is it more infectious? And what we're seeing with some of these is that that is true. So the UK variant, for example, is about 70% more infectious than the COVID strain that's been pretty predominant in the United States. Another big question that comes up is, are these more fatal? And some, there's a little bit of debate, I would say, on some of these different elements. The UK B117, which is that variant we've heard a lot about from the United Kingdom, there's some reports suggesting that maybe it is a little bit more fatal than the strain we've had in the US. The third question, though, that I think we kind of have to wrap our heads around is, do these mutations impact our vaccination efforts? And so what's interesting is when you look at all these different variants, a lot of them actually have mutations of the spike protein, which is what, at least for the vaccines in the United States, we've been targeting for our primary vaccine methods. So to date, the good news is the vaccines seem to be holding out against the variants as far as what's been studied. We know that the Pfizer vaccine seems to be active against the South African strain and the UK strain. And the Moderna vaccine did show some activity as well, although they've actually noted that it was a little bit more blunted in their response with the South African variant. So what they're suggesting that they may do is create a booster shot where they can actually start to protect against these other variants. So that's going to be an ongoing discussion as we continue to see these different variants emerge.
Dr. Jenkins, you mentioned that you are not surprised that there have been different variants of the coronavirus that causes COVID-19. There are also different strains of the seasonal flu. Is this something that is analogous to that?
Yeah, it's very similar in a lot of ways in that, you know, the flu tends to emerge every year. We see a lot of different variants. And what we do with the vaccine is we typically predict the most likely variants that we'll see. As you're probably aware, many people are probably aware, the vaccine with the flu is typically not 100% successful. It's usually around 50% or maybe less. And the reason for that is there are so many variants, and the flu happens to mutate very rapidly. The nice thing about the COVID virus in comparison is that it doesn't mutate quite as quickly. But even so, we're still seeing these mutants emerge.
So that's what we know about the coronavirus variants. In your opinion, where are our knowledge gaps? What don't we know?
It's a great question. I think there's some big questions we have to kind of think about with these variants, not only with infectivity rates and mortality, but are any of them more prone to triggering certain kinds of immune responses? So it's kind of expanding on that question in mortality. You know, we've known, for example, with COVID that it does cause a lot of blood clots. One thing we might start to ask ourselves as well, are any of these variants worse when it comes to that? Do the symptoms appear in greater frequency with certain variants than with others? So those are things we'll have to think about. And why that's an important question for us is it will drive drug development. It'll drive our therapeutic efforts. With the new variants emerging too, from a research perspective, we have to dive back in with the vaccines we have developed to test them and make sure that they are still efficacious against these things. And in some cases, we actually may have to supplement the vaccines we've already brought to market or make slight tweaks in them based on those results that we do find. We're getting a lot of concern that's arising with these variants, but to just to kind of assuage, I think, your listeners, Paul Offit, who is an infectious disease physician and also a member of the FDA's vaccine advisory panel, he's come out with a statement about how he's only mildly concerned with these variants and as far as our vaccination efforts go. So we have hope on that horizon still, and I think we're still in a good position when it comes to that.
That was Dr. Zach Jenkins, an associate professor of pharmacy practice with Cedarville University in Ohio, speaking to International Edition's Steve Miller. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa is calling on wealthy countries to, in his words, stop hoarding coronavirus vaccines so that poorer countries can have access to them too. Ramaphosa spoke at a virtual meeting of the World Economic Forum Tuesday, as VOA's Mariama Diallo reports.
South Africa is by far the African continent's hardest hit nation by COVID-19, with more than 1.4 million cases and over 41,000 deaths, according to official country data. Curbing the pandemic will require more vaccines for South Africa and other developing nations, says President Cyril Ramaphosa. He told the World Economic Forum Tuesday he's concerned that vaccines are being hoarded.
We need those who have hoarded the vaccines to release the vaccines so that other countries can have them. But
Ramaphosa went on to accuse rich countries of acquiring more vaccines than they need, something that will hurt global recovery efforts, he says.
And some countries have even gone beyond and acquired up to four times what their population needs. And that was aimed at hoarding these vaccines. And now this is being done to the exclusion of other countries in the world that most need this.
Earlier in January, the World Health Organization warned the so-called vaccine nationalism will cause an economic and moral catastrophe.
The world is on the brink of a catastrophic moral failure.
A point echoed by the head of the International Chamber of Commerce, who said Monday the unequal distribution of vaccines could cause more than $9 trillion of damage to the global economy. John W. H. Denton.
Japan can frankly do more. Canada can do more. Australia can do more. The constituent members of the European Union must do more as well.
Western nations, including Britain, Canada, Germany, Italy, and Sweden, have jointly pledged nearly $1 billion to COVAX, an initiative by the World Health Organization to ensure poor countries get affordable vaccines. The Biden administration recently announced the U.S. will also participate in the global initiative. On Friday, Pfizer committed to providing about 40 million doses of its COVID-19 vaccine to COVAX this year. German Chancellor Angela Merkel told the World Economic Forum a broad response is needed.
It has become even clearer to me than it was before that we need to choose a multilateral approach.
Merkel said a self-isolating approach won't solve a global pandemic. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
This is VOA. The United States has called for all Eritrean troops to immediately withdraw from Ethiopia's conflict-torn Tigray region, given credible reports of looting, sexual violence, assaults in refugee camps, and other human rights abuses. In a statement to VOA, a State Department spokesperson also cited evidence of Eritrean soldiers forcibly returning Eritrean refugees from Tigray to Eritrea. The U.S. is also, quote, gravely concerned by credible reports that hundreds of thousands of people may starve to death if urgent humanitarian assistance is not mobilized immediately, end quote, the spokesperson said. The spokesperson called for safe and unhindered humanitarian access to the region. Despite agreements between the United Nations and Ethiopia's government to allow full humanitarian access to Tigray, aid workers remain unable to freely access the region. Eritrea has not commented on the accusations that its forces are in Tigray. Ethiopian government and military officials have variously acknowledged or denied the presence of Eritrean troops. Today is Holocaust Remembrance Day, and hundreds of Holocaust survivors in Austria and Slovakia were poised to get their first dose of the coronavirus vaccination today. More than 400 Austrian survivors, most in their 80s or 90s, were expected to receive the first dose administered by a team of Viennese Jewish doctors. Holocaust Remembrance Day remembers the Nazi-led genocide of over 6 million European Jews. The day takes place on the anniversary of the 1945 liberation of the Auschwitz death camp, where the Nazis murdered more than 1 million Jews and others. With the end of World War II now more than 7 decades ago, the world's approximately 240,000 Holocaust survivors are all elderly. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. A Kenyan man suspected of conspiracy to traffic in rhinoceros horns and elephant ivory has been extradited to the U.S. Mansour Mohamed Sarur was allegedly involved in the illegal poaching of more than 35 rhinoceros and more than 100 elephants. For more on the significance of the extradition, International Edition's Chinedu O4 reached out to Crawford Allen, who is an expert on wildlife trafficking and trade at the Worldwide Fund for Nature. Here's a clip of their conversation.
This is a very serious case, and so it could be a game-changing tactic to disrupt and deter wildlife trafficking syndicates and to bring justice in countries that have had offenses committed within them, like the U.S. in this alleged case. So in some cases, this could be a deal approach, because also penalties in the legal system systems in the countries to which somebody is extradited to may be more robust and may be more appropriate. And some countries' judicial systems can have higher levels of corruption. Local offenders may have connections within legal circles too. So it could be a better option in some cases. So they're likely to, obviously, to, if proven guilty, send a strong message out there to other criminal networks that there is a risk of extradition now for wildlife trafficking, wildlife crime.
How serious is this illegal trade in wildlife?
Well, you know, the illegal trade in wildlife has kind of exploded in the last 15 years or so, driven by this increased wealth in key consumer markets. markets, people that will pay premiums for this rare and unusual wildlife and products, incredible prices. And the demand for elephant ivory and rhino horn in particular has been the driver of poaching and trafficking crisis that caused massive losses in Africa. And at its peak in 2011 to 2013, some 30,000 elephants were being poached in Africa for their ivory on an annual basis. And while luckily, and thanks to a number of efforts, wild elephant ivory trafficking has been declining, the criminal networks have just swapped elephant ivory for other species like pangolins and pangolin scales. These are kind of a scaly anteater. They've now gone up to the top of the poacher's hit list, unfortunately. This really is around the involvement of organized crime. It's facilitated this high profit and low risk smuggling to illicit markets. And it's almost become almost like an industrialized wildlife crime operation. Governments really have woken up to these threats of this illegal wildlife trade. And it's because it doesn't just impact nature. It really impacts people, local communities, local economies, but also the general rule of law and national security. And as in the case we saw here, there was a convergence of wildlife trafficking with heroin smuggling and drug smuggling. And, you know, they're both going hand in hand in more and more cases that we're seeing with different types of illegal trafficking taking place with alongside wildlife.
Some are saying that the demand for wildlife is being driven to a large extent by economic factors. Do you agree?
I think economics come into everything. And of course, demand is economic in the sense that there is more affluence in some of the key markets that we've seen open up in recent years in Asia. There's been a sort of a cachet around the rare and unusual. And people with disposable incomes are now looking to show off that they've got the rarest and most unusual item or food or clothing or statue or whatever it might be. And they're willing to pay a premium for those things that are not caring that they're prohibited, not caring that they could be driving species to extinction. And so that's generated this dynamic where there's an enormous amount of profit that can be made in selling items that really on the ground can be found in some places not very well protected in remote areas. And a high level of profit for low investment and low risk can really is really driving this. It is the economics of demand. And until we shift that demand dynamic, this problem will continue to persist.
What ways do you think this demand can either be reduced or stopped entirely?
You're probably never going to stop demand entirely, but I think there are signs that you can really impact it significantly. And there's a number of different methods around that. And obviously, typically, changing consumer behavior in the past has focused largely around public service announcements, videos, and awareness brochures and that kind of thing. And some of them were quite crude and not really tailored to the audience and understanding what you can do to change consumer behavior and hit those triggers that will actually mean that it resonates with the audience you're trying to reach.
That's Crawford Allen from the Worldwide Fund for Nature. He was speaking with my colleague Chinedu Ofor from New York. Indonesia's most active volcano has erupted with a river of lava and searing gas clouds flowing down its slopes. Authorities in November had evacuated nearly 2,000 people living on Mount Merapi on Java Island, but most have since returned. There has been no new evacuation, and the existing warning for people is to keep at least 3 miles from the crater. The U.S. Senate on Tuesday rejected a Republican effort to stop former President Donald Trump's coming impeachment trial on a charge that he incited the deadly January 6th assault on the U.S. Capitol. Gavino Garay of Reuters reports.
Will all senators now rise and raise their right hand?
U.S. senators on Tuesday were sworn in for the impeachment trial of former U.S. President Donald Trump, the only president to have been impeached by the House of Representatives twice and the first to face a trial after leaving power. Right off the bat, Republican Senator Rand Paul attempted to halt Trump's upcoming trial on the basis that it is unconstitutional because Trump is no longer president.
Article 2, Section 4 of the Constitution says, "The president, vice president, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors." As of noon last Wednesday, Donald Trump holds none of the positions listed in the Constitution. He is a private citizen.
That effort failed, but 44 Republican senators sided with Paul, including now Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who said just last week that Trump provoked the mob that stormed the Capitol. Only 5 Republicans voted down the effort, which signals a weak appetite among GOP lawmakers to convict the former president. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer hit back at the notion of constitutionality.
By constitutional text, precedent and common basic sense, it is clearly and certainly constitutional to hold a trial for a former official. Former President Trump committed, in the view of many, including myself, the gravest offense ever committed by a president of the United States.
That offense being the incitement of insurrection by Trump supporters on January 6th, while Congress was in session to symbolically certify Electoral College votes confirming Joe Biden as president. The trial is set to begin on February 9th. At least 17 Republicans would need to join all 50 Democrats in the evenly divided Senate for Trump to be convicted, a two-thirds threshold that appears unlikely to be reached.
That was Gavino Garay of Reuters. The U.S. Senate has confirmed President Joe Biden's nominee Antony Blinken to lead the U.S. State Department. As VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports, Blinken faces numerous challenges worldwide as the nation's top diplomat.
Antony Blinken, now set to become the nation's 71st Secretary of State.
The yeas are 78, the nays are 22. The nomination is confirmed.
After the U.S. Senate confirmed President Joe Biden's nominee Tuesday in a bipartisan vote of 78-22, Blinken, welcomed by many Democrats as a change in direction from the Trump administration's America First foreign policy. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer.
Mr. Blinken is just the right person to rebuild and reassert America's national security prerogatives on the global stage and reestablish the first instrument of American power, diplomacy.
Blinken has decades of experience in foreign policy, both on Capitol Hill and as Deputy Secretary of State in the Obama administration. Experience, some Republicans argued, would only maintain the status quo in U.S. foreign policy. Republican Senator Rand Paul.
Mr. Blinken has been a full-throated advocate of military intervention in the Middle East for 20 years. We're fooling ourselves if we think we're going to get a new policy. We're going to get more of the same.
Other Republican senators supported his nomination while dissenting on the new administration's approach to the Iran nuclear deal. Republican Senator Jim Raich.
The JCPOA was a colossal failure and a real blunder for American policy overseas. In talking with Mr. Blinken, he does not share that view, and obviously he's going to work with the president, carrying the president's water, to get us back into the JCPOA.
Blinken told senators in a confirmation hearing last week the U.S. relationship with China is a top concern. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
We have to start by approaching China from a position of strength, not weakness. And the good news is our ability to do that is largely within our control. Position of strength when we are working with, not denigrating, our allies. That's a source of strength for us in dealing with China.
Analysts say Blinken will also face the task of rebuilding the U.S. State Department following a turbulent period. Center for American Progress fellow Brian Katulis.
After 4 years of Pompeo and Tillerson and Trump, I think morale is quite low. But then it's a longer standing problem where I think many in the diplomatic corps feel like they've taken a back seat to what the Pentagon and the U.S. military have done in terms of dominating the U.S. foreign policy and our approach to the world.
Blinken takes on that challenge after a relatively non-confrontational confirmation process. Democratic Senator Bob Menendez.
He has thoughtful, willing, able to grapple with the most complex, challenging issues facing our country, and committed to engaging Congress. And he did so on both sides of the aisle.
Blinken is the fourth Biden cabinet nominee to be confirmed in the past week. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
That was VOA's congressional correspondent, Catherine Gibson, and that's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Hi, this is Kim Lewis. Join me this weekend for a special edition of Press Conference USA with guest Jesse Holland, historian, journalist, and author, as we examine the dynamics of protesting from Dr. Martin Luther King's March on Washington to the recent attack on the U.S. Capitol. Don't miss Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice.